It's been heralded as the most concentrated distillation of Vladimir Nabokov's creativity. Also, a potentially totally radical book, very different from the rest of his oeuvre. The book is an unfinished, unpublished fragment of a novel that Nabokov was working on when he died in 1977. And both of those descriptions come from Nabokov's son Dmitri, one of only a couple of people who have ever seen the manuscript, titled The Original of Laura. Vladimir Nabokov wanted the incomplete manuscript destroyed after his death, and over the last 30 years, Dmitri Nabokov has been deciding whether to honor his father's request, while many Nabokov readers have been salivating over the prospect that he would instead publish. Well, now, Dmitri Nabokov says he has made up his mind that Laura will be published. And Mr. Nabokov joins us from his home in Palm Beach, Florida, to talk about his decision. And Mr. Nabokov, first of all, is this a final decision? Are you actually going to finally publish Laura?
Well, I've been vacillating not between destroying it and not. I wouldn't have wanted to go down in history as a literary arsonist. We're going to keep it alive, not destroy it, not burn it, not shred it. And my only vacillations and the long process of maturing for this novel has been for me how to preserve it, whether to salt it away in some repository where it would inevitably be eventually discovered and read, or whether to present this wonderful gift to the public now, while I'm still alive and can perhaps direct operations.
And you've said you decided not to burn it, but in fact, will it be presented to readers? Will it be published in book form?
It will be published in original form. The principal section of the book already has been transformed into a transcript. And then there's a section that follows. My father wrote on index cards, as perhaps you know, and some of the cards will be transcribed and have in fact been transcribed, while others represent draft fragments, possible continuations. They will be printed exactly as my father penciled them and included in the package.
Now, how many index cards did your father complete?
There were 138 in all.
And 138 cards would come out to how many pages typed up?
Well, I think that the total package will be maybe 100, give or take.
And when do you figure this will come out?
That's what everybody wants to know. I wish I do. One is subject to the laws and norms of the publishing industry. One does not like to reveal too much until the final dotted line has been definitively inked by agents and publishers. So I'm forbidden, and nor can I cite a date. I hope it'll be fairly soon.
Did your father tell you directly, as he was dying, burn this book?
No. He told my mother, but she was a very faithful emissary.
Your mother?
Yes, but she didn't. She was quite old. She was quite unwell and getting worse, unfortunately. And above all, she didn't have the courage, not the courage, perhaps the desire even to destroy such a beautiful thing. And as things happened, the problem was inherited by me.
Well, since your father had expressly said, I do not want this book published, in fact, I want it destroyed, how did you finally decide to say it will be published?
My father was running the last yards of a 100-yard or 100-card dash to achieve this work before he died. It has been asked by people with limited perception, why didn't he do it ahead of time? Because he wanted to finish it. He was hoping to finish it. He certainly wouldn't have destroyed it or wanted it destroyed had he finished it. But he did not want unfinished bits trailing behind him after his death. That was his only reason. And unfortunately, he did not finish it until the last moment, practically. He was writing in his hospital bed. This task would have been horrendous, and that's why I put it off. And I came to the very clear conclusion, imagining my father with a wry smile in a calmer and happier moment, saying, well, you're in a real mess here. Go ahead and publish. Have some fun.
Have some fun.
In fact, the provisional title for the novel was Dying is Fun, which he later replaced simply by the original of Laura.
Well, what can you tell us, Mr. Nabokov, about what is in this book? What does it tell us? What's the story?
Well, again, I'm not supposed to let cats out of the bag. Quite a few kittens have been running around already. It's basically the story of a brilliant neurologist who is hopelessly fat, tormented by his young wife, who is hopelessly promiscuous. This leads him on to the thought of suicide. And being a man of imagination and scientific talent, he thinks about a suicide, but a reversible suicide. And he imagines himself progressively destroying his own body from the toes up. One must mention here that he was been having, had been having a great deal of trouble with inflammations of the toes and nails, and that I think influenced him somewhat. And this gradual destruction would eliminate his body part by part. But he could project this process on a hidden screen, which was the inside of his retina, and allow him in time to stop and reverse. He wrote, in fact, if I may, this is the one little quote which I would like to bestow upon you. I'm not allowed to quote very much. He wrote, "A process of self-obliteration conducted by an effort of the will, pleasure bordering on almost unendurable ecstasy." For it was a work of pleasure and ecstasy performed in this manner.
Do you, when you read this manuscript, do you see elements of your father's other works in there? Do you see shades of Lolita or Ada or Pale Fire or anything else?
Well, I have lived with Laura for quite a while, and she has been a capricious concubine. I'm sure she's glad to have been permitted to live, and perhaps even to influence.
This concubine of yours, happy not to have been sent to the fire.
Very happy, I think. And I think she will make a lot of people happy.
Do you think this book will change the way that we read Nabokov, or how we think of him as a writer?
For me, possibly because, well, when I read my father, every book of his that I read, work on, translate, at that moment becomes my favorite, I might say. And they form a kind of artistic palimpsest in the mind. Each new book gives new angles and arouses new concepts and new interpretations, even in the previous ones.
Well, Dmitri Nabokov, thanks for sharing a glimmer of what is in the original of Laura with us and for talking to us today.
My pleasure.
Dmitri Nabokov talking with us from Palm Beach about his decision to go ahead and publish his father's book, The Original of Laura, which he has described as both a spellbinding thing and a terrible thorn.
Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid says he still has one flattened-out knuckle from a fist fight when he was a kid. In a new book called The Good Fight, Reid says he's been combative all his life, yet the Senate's top Democrat is in a job that requires getting along.
What we do here in Washington, much of it is based upon personal relationships.
One of those relationships is with President Bush, a man that Reid does not pretend to like. In his book, he is openly critical of the president, right down to the way the president runs meetings at the White House, which Reid says are nothing more than political theater.
He does the same thing in every meeting. He tells you what he wants to hear. He goes around the table, Madam Speaker, what would you like to say? Senator Reid, I mean, that's it, and it's over with.
I want to talk more about President Bush, but before I do, I want to ask about Washington generally and Congress as well. Is that kind of meeting, in a way, symptomatic of Congress right now? People talk past each other. They don't talk to each other. They give empty speeches to an empty Senate chamber. Maybe somebody's watching on C-SPAN, and then another empty speech.
No, I don't believe that. I think this is a Bush phenomenon. This book that I wrote talks about the uniqueness of President Bush. There's a difference between President Bush Sr. and President Bush Jr. The first President Bush was someone who was well prepared for the job. He was a uniter, not a divider. And we have this man come to town who pronounces in Orwellian speech that he wants to be uniter, not a divider. He meant just the opposite. Because we've been 7-plus years, he hasn't tried to unite anything for anybody.
Do you feel differently about the Republicans that you have to deal with every day in the Senate?
Oh, much so. I have prided myself in my political career of being somebody who is a peacemaker.
You write with some frustration about Republicans who might be seen as moderate on some issues, but you say that they're only with you when you don't need them.
Yeah, what I talk about in the book is that the Republicans in the Senate today do not represent Republicans throughout the country. The Republican Senate is composed of people who are really very, 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 very conservative. Some would say very right-wing. There are a few moderates. Olympia Snow is one. Arlen Specter, I say in the book, he votes with us whenever we don't need him. When it's a throwaway vote, he'll vote with us. But when it means something, he never votes with us.
You make the same complaint about Richard Lugar of Indiana, very respected foreign policy person, but you say that he's, quote, as obedient as ever when it comes to the war in Iraq.
Oh, very much so. I mean, he gives a big speech before the committee that we got to change course on Iraq. It's just wrong what's going on there. We have a vote. Within a week later, he votes with the Republicans. I mean, we were stunned that he would do this.
When you see someone like Senator Lugar in the hall, do you speak to him the way that you write
of course,
of him?
I have great respect for
Senator. But, I mean, do you say, Senator Lugar, looks like you were obedient as ever? I mean, how do you communicate that in a way that maintains a relationship?
Well, I've said things, of course, that have gotten a little heated. For example, I said they're just like a bunch of puppets. And there was people, somebody came and gave a speech. How could a majority leader say that? That's what I thought they were. So that's what I said.
Because you've written a lot here about growing up in a small town, an extremely small failing town, a mining town, Searchlight, Nevada, I want to ask how that experience has informed your political philosophy.
When I was growing up in Searchlight, I didn't realize that most of the people there were people who had no place else to go. There was no work.
The gold was out of the ground for the most part.
Gold was out of the ground, with rare exception. At the time, I didn't know things were difficult. But as I look back, they were pretty hard for me and a lot of other people in Searchlight. What I've learned is that we should try to make it easier for the Harry Reids of the world, not have as many hoops for them to jump through.
What kind of health care did your family have?
Well, I talk about in my book about my father pulling some of his teeth with a pair of pliers.
Because he couldn't afford a dentist?
That's right. And I talk about my brother breaking his leg, laying there writhing in pain. And that went on for days.
You never went to a doctor?
No. He just laid in the bed. He couldn't touch the bed. I can remember that because it moved the bed and it hurt so bad. My mother had no teeth. So health care is something that I'm very concerned about. And recognizing that 50 million people have no health insurance today doesn't make me feel good about it.
Why do you think it is small towns like that in recent elections have voted very heavily Republican?
I said after John Kerry lost, I gave my first press conference, I said, I think one reason that he lost is he didn't campaign in rural America, and I believe that. We in past years, as Democrats, have tried to win election in big cities, and we were fairly successful doing that for a long, long time. Can't do that anymore.
Well, do you think if someone like John Kerry had showed up in rural Nevada, he would have won?
Absolutely. Picked up enough votes to win.
Absolutely. You think that his philosophy would have matched with the philosophy of
people in
small towns?
No question about it.
I don't want to be the 1,000th person to ask you if you're going to support Clinton or Obama. What I do want to know is, as a superdelegate and party leader, how do you intend to make up your mind?
First of all, I'm going to be very patient. The primaries are not over with yet. And I think that shortly after the primaries are ended, there will be people like me making a decision.
Do you think that superdelegates should go the way that the majority or the largest number of delegates have gone, for example?
I think superdelegates have the opportunity, the ability, and the right to vote for whoever they want, and I think that's what they should do.
Could you imagine being in a situation yourself where you decide that what's best for the country is supporting the candidate who is behind?
Behind is in the mind of the beholder. As President Clinton called me over the weekend explaining all the reasons why he felt that Senator Clinton was somebody who was going to be able to be ahead at the end of the primary.
That's the way President Clinton sees it. Is that the way you see it as well?
Well, I'm not siding with anybody.
Although, let me just lay this out. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi was on our air saying she was uncommitted in such a way that people interpreted her as supporting Barack Obama. I could imagine people listening to what you just said and interpreting that as you back Hillary Clinton, even though your situation calls for you to officially remain neutral.
Well, I guess someone can interpret that if they had a bizarre way of thinking, but at this stage, I've been very noncommittal. The only thing I guess they could get an indication of that is that President Clinton called me. Well, everybody should understand Barack Obama's called me a few times, too.
Senator Harry Reid, thanks very much.
You bet.
Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid's new book is called The Good Fight: Hard Lessons from Searchlight to Washington, and you can read an excerpt at npr.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
If you're looking for proof that teenagers aren't only interested in texting their friends or finding out who got booted off American Idol, there is Poetry Out Loud. It's a recitation contest sponsored by the National Endowment for the Arts and the Poetry Foundation, and the winner will be announced tonight. About 200,000 high school students took part in this year's competition. They recited poetry of all kinds from memory. NPR's Elizabeth Blair listens in.
At Lisner Auditorium on the campus of George Washington University, the theater is pitch dark. The audience is quiet. Four judges sit down in front. The only thing on stage is a microphone. One by one, students take their turns.
Death, be not proud, though some have called.
Don't do it. She's the wrong woman.
At pet stores in Detroit, you can buy frozen rats for 75 cents a piece.
America settles in the mold of its vulgarity, heavily thickening to empire.
I want to say, just got to say something about those beautiful, 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 out of sight black men.
Students from all 50 states, the District of Columbia, and the U.S. Virgin Islands have recited a lot of poetry to make it this far in high school, regional, and state contests. The judging is tough. Students are scored on physical presence, voice and articulation, level of difficulty, and understanding. They pick three poems from a list of about 600. Dana Gioia is chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts.
And what we really want to do is to open up the whole world of poetry to these kids and show them that almost anything that's part of human experience, there is a great poem about.
Fever 103 by Sylvia Plath.
Allison Strong is the finalist from New Jersey. She says she practiced with her teachers and poets in residence at her high school in Union City. It took her a while to get Sylvia Plath right.
It's very easy to get a little overdramatic with that poem. In my classroom competition, I flailed my arms around and I was screaming and it was ridiculous. And then the poets in residence, the judges told me afterwards, "You did great, but you need to tone it down."
Pure. What does it mean? The tongues of hell are dull. Dull as the triple tongues of dull fat Cerberus who wheezes at the gate.
Allison Strong also recited a Shakespeare sonnet and Allen Ginsberg's Supermarket. She'll go on to compete in Poetry Out Loud's final round tonight. Students are encouraged to choose poems of different styles and time periods.
She Walks in Beauty by Lord Byron.
Tia Robinson, the finalist from Virginia, showed real talent for conveying a poem's meaning, but also for making it her own. She recited poems by Nikki Giovanni and Lucille Clifton. The one who gave her the most trouble, Lord Byron.
He's a man, and I'm a woman, you know. He's Caucasian, and I'm African American, so it's kind of hard to put yourself in those shoes when you don't really know how he's feeling.
So Tia Robinson pretended she was reading the poem to her mother, who died when Tia was 2.
A mind at peace with all below. A heart whose love is innocent.
Tia Robinson did not make it to tonight's final round, but she's only a sophomore and plans to compete next year. In the lead-up to the first Poetry Out Loud 3 years ago, there were complaints that making teenagers memorize poems would just turn them off. But the program is entirely voluntary, and it has grown exponentially. Poet Holly Bass is one of the judges.
There's nothing like being able to recall some beautiful literature by heart. And the fact that it is almost a lost art in America, it just makes this kind of competition all the more important.
Tonight, 12 students are competing in Washington, D.C. to become Poetry Out Loud's national champion. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
Yesterday, we brought you a story about Poetry Out Loud. That's a national recitation contest. And last night, 12 finalists faced off for the national championship, reciting by memory poems by Edna St. Vincent Millay, Martina Spada, and Kathy Song, among others.
And now we bring you the winner, Shantae Henry of St. Thomas in the U.S. Virgin Islands. Here's Ms. Henry with the poem Frederick Douglass, written in the middle of the last century by Robert E. Hayden.
When it is finally ours. This freedom, this liberty, this beautiful and terrible thing, needful to man as air, usable as earth, when it belongs at last to all, when it is truly instinct, brain matter, diastole, systole, reflex, action, when it is finally one, when it is more than the gaudy mumbo jumbo of politicians, this man, this Douglas, this former slave, this Negro, beaten to his knees, exiled, visioning a world where none is lonely, none hunted, alien. This man, superb in love and logic, this man shall be remembered. Oh, not with statutes, rhetoric, not with legends and poems and wreaths of bronze alone, but with the lives grown out of his life, the lives fleshing his dream of the beautiful, needful thing.
Shante Henry, reciting the poem Frederick Douglass by Robert E. Hayden. Yesterday, with that performance, she became the national champion of this year's Poetry Out Loud competition. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. I didn't know, until I read the new book by Tony Horwitz, I didn't know that Christopher Columbus thought the Earth was shaped like a pear with a stalk like a woman's nipple, promising earthly paradise at the tip. That was one surprise among many for Horwitz as he tried to fill in the gaps of how America was settled by retracing the roots of the earliest explorers and conquerors. His journey begins after he pays a visit to Plymouth, Massachusetts. A park ranger at Plymouth Rock tells him people keep asking, why does the rock say 1620 and not 1492?
Many visitors think that Columbus sailed to America, dropped off the pilgrims, and sailed home. They learn about 1492 in school and a little bit about the pilgrims, and they don't remember anything else about this period. At the time, this amused me, but then I began scanning my own brain to see what I could retrieve from this period, and basically nothing. There was this 130-year period where I couldn't come up with anything, basically between Columbus in 1492 and the arrival of English settlers in the early 1600s. And that's what really set me to thinking about what happened and what could I find out about it.
You go off retracing a lot of the steps of the adventurers in this country. A number of them are the Spanish conquistadors. And we, you know, if we think about the Spanish presence in the United States, we might think about New Mexico and Arizona. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't have thought about Kansas.
Well, exactly. I associated conquistadors with Cortez in Mexico and Pizarro in Peru. But the conquistadors who came here didn't just go along the fringes of Florida and the Southwest. They reached about half of the states in the present-day continental U.S. They crossed the Appalachian Mountains, they went down the Grand Canyon, they rafted down the Mississippi, and Coronado and his horsemen galloped all the way to central Kansas, almost the exact geographic center of the continent, in the 1540s. And I don't think this is the way most Americans think about their early history.
They were flabbergasted when they got to the plains. They could not imagine what this territory was that they were seeing.
Right. They'd never seen someplace so flat. So they describe it, you know, as a sea of grass. One of them lies down on the ground and marvels that he can't even see the earth. It's so flat, all he can see is sky. And they were, of course, also stunned by buffalo.
We're talking about the more benign side of the Spanish adventures in America. What was the main through line of that journey was unmitigated killing and destruction of the Indian people that they encountered.
Right. Yeah, the Spanish conquest and this whole period, not just the Spanish, the French, the English, Portuguese, everyone who came here, it's not a pretty tale.
They also seem to have been very scrupulous about documenting exactly what they did. You found no shortage of resources right. to go back and figure out what had happened.
The Spanish in particular were great record keepers, and like perpetrators of later centuries, they even documented their torture, execution, and other atrocities committed against natives. So there's no shortage of records in their own words describing the pain and misery inflicted on native people.
Let's talk about one of these painful chapters. It was the conquistador Juan de Oñate. This was almost in 1600, taking on the Acoma people in what's now New Mexico.
Oñate was a hard-handed man, even by conquistador standards. And when the Acoma Indians killed about 15 of his men, he sent essentially a revenge party that burned Acoma, killed hundreds of natives, and then brought back many more as prisoners. Oñate put them on trial, and he found them guilty. And the ones over about the age of 15 had their hands or feet cut off, enslaved them, essentially destroyed this culture, which remarkably recovered several decades later, returned to Acoma, and you can visit it today, the Sky City of Acoma. Some people think it may be the oldest inhabited place on the North American continent.
And they have by no means forgotten what happened back in the 16th century.
I mean, one of the fascinating things about taking this parallel journey on the path of these explorers was to find how vivid this long-ago history still is, particularly for Native peoples. And a few years ago, when a statue of Oñate went up in New Mexico, somebody snuck up in the night and cut off his foot, as Oñate had done to Indians many, many centuries ago, and sent a note to newspapers essentially explaining why they had done this.
This was a big statue. It took some effort to cut off that.
Yeah, they needed a power grinder. I went to see this statue. It was an enormous equestrian statue modeled on one of, you know, Marcus Aurelius in Rome. And they snuck up in the night, just took off his foot. It's since been replaced, but you can see the slight scar.
It struck me that you get a lot of your best imparted wisdom from park rangers, who are often in places that people just don't show up. So they must have been really glad to see you. And one of them was in Florida, in Jacksonville, at Fort Caroline National Memorial, a Huguenot settlement in Florida, which he calls, the park ranger himself calls, Fort Fakey.
Yeah. Well, the French story in Florida was, I think, the single most astonishing to me, that there were French Protestants seeking religious liberty in this country 60 years before the Pilgrims arrive, and that they almost succeeded. They're driven out by the Spanish, and now they have a small national park near Jacksonville, but unfortunately they don't really know what the fort looked like or where exactly it was, so they've built a log stockade that this ranger referred to as, Fort Fakey.
In a burst of honesty.
Yeah.
And he says, you know, if the French had succeeded, we'd be eating beignets instead of barbecue, and France would have been spared Euro Disney.
He was a ranger who had a sense of humor, but I think he's also onto something. Our destiny as an Anglo nation was by no means manifest in this period. At the time that the French and Spanish were fighting it out over Florida, there wasn't a single English person on this continent. So if you roll your mind back to that era, that we would be sitting here today speaking English, and that I would be living in a gloomy place called New England, would have been unimaginable. So I think part of what I wanted to do is restore a little bit of the unpredictability to history. It didn't have to unfold this way. It could well have gone very differently.
You end this journey where you started it, in Plymouth, Massachusetts, and you decide with your new knowledge to sort of take it to a bar and test out your theory that maybe Plymouth is not as central to our myth of America as people would believe. It doesn't go over too well in the bar.
Yeah. So I went to this bar and essentially picked a fight with the man who was sitting next to me, who happened to be a tour bus driver. And I said, many people in this country wouldn't regard this as really the beginning of our European story. What about the Spanish? What about Jamestown and St. Augustine? And I went on, and he finally got so annoyed, he slammed his hand on the bar and shouted, "Forget all the others. This is the frigging beginning of America." So I think once these myths are embedded, they're almost impossible to dislodge. And I think in the end, I concluded, we're stuck with these stories, whether they're true or not.
Tony Horwitz, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
You can read the prologue of Tony Horwitz's new book, A Voyage Long and Strange, at npr.org/books.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.